Don K. He's got a heart bigger than himself, and he's big enough for me. Love you, Don. Up, Sligo.
Right, thanks, Mark. Kid me LaForcia. You were trying to say. And it's nice to be here. Nice to see a few faces I know, and nice to meet a few new faces. I'm Don, and I'm an alcoholic. And yeah, Mark asked me if I'd do a chair on my birthday, and I'm a bit I don't know. I'm a bit dubious about doing a chair on my birthday because I've heard several younger members talk about older members, or people that's a long time in the fellowship, kind of taking a senior role or kind of showing seniority or something like that in the fellowship, you know, which is not something I ever found. I always found people, you know, members talked about the work. They were just sober one day at a time, and whoever was up first that day was the longest sober, really. That it doesn't, you know, you don't get your wings, you know. It's not like you're a fucking pilot or something. You never actually get your wings, you know. We're all always working towards sobriety, really, is the way I look at it. I remember years ago when I was quite young reading one of the little snippets in a Reader's Digest, you know, the little things after. I think most people have read a Reader's Digest, must have, you know. And there's little words of wisdom after after some of the stories and so on. I remember one that I read a long time ago. I don't know why it stuck, but it says that nobody can stand up and say they're in a perfect state of mental health, that mental health is achieved in working towards it, you know. So I must have fucking known there was something wrong with me back then. You know, I was only a kid that time. I think I learned to read from the Reader's Digest because my neighbors, they got it every month, a month late, because they had a daughter in England that used to get it and then post it on. So it was a month late, but nonetheless, it came into the house. And I used to read any little stories that looked interesting, you know. But that was interesting. I've heard an interesting thing during the week. There's a sad death, a man called Tony Slattery. I don't know how many of you knew him, Tony Slattery. He was a very well-known comedian in England. Radio listeners would have known him. He was on Radio 4 a lot, and he was one of those from the Footlights in Cambridge. He was one of those comedians, you know, from them times. But he got mental illness, and he changed from being a real clean-cut guy like Jimmy Carr is, you know. And he got he just like aged overnight, it seemed, you know. And he was on TV being interviewed, and he looked really wrecked, you know. And the guy that was doing the interview, he asked him some question. I didn't see the question, but Slattery answered him. He said nobody in their right mind would choose to be mentally ill, you know, which was his humor, no. It's good old English humor. And nobody in their right mind would choose to be alcoholic either, I guess. You know, you could apply it to our state, you know. It's something that happens like insidiously, you know. I had no idea it would happen to me. I thought it was something I had to do, you know, that I had to be a drinker. But I was an immigrant, really, you know, working in, like millions of Irish people done, or hundreds of thousands at least. You know, I went to England when I was 16, and I started to work there, and it was either go to the pub and meet friends or else fucking stay at home in a flat, you know. So it wasn't much of a choice, you know. So I got the habit of going to the pub, and we know now that, you know, our brain will develop an addiction to something like that when you do it all the time. And that's kind of what happened to me too, and I got into various sorts of trouble, and it looked like I was never going to be able to put a life together for myself. And you know, I guess I had a rock bottom, and I got into AA, and I have to say it worked for me from the word go. You know, I haven't had a drink since my first meeting, and I felt that I couldn't have, because I would have fucking lost everything again. I was in a reasonably good position when I came in a way. I was 26 years old. I felt like an old man, but I realize now I didn't feel like an old man, because I kind of am old now, and I still feel much better now than I did then, you know. But I had a few things going for me, and it takes too long to tell them, but I had a few things going for me. The most important being a girlfriend. And I hadn't had a girlfriend for a few years because of the way I was a down and out, you know, and I wasn't doing very well. And I pulled myself together at one stage and I got a fairly good job over in Rotterdam in Holland. And it was good money, like fucking six times more than you'd get working in England. And something else happened for me too. I was a first-class citizen in Holland, which I didn't feel I was in England, to be honest. No, no disrespect to anybody English here, but that is a reality, you know. And or it was a reality in the 70s. Hopefully it's getting better now. But and I just, you know, I kind of became a going concern. I don't know if I became a going concern again or if I became a going concern for the first time, really, that year when the year I was 25. I think it was 70, 1978. And I came back to Ireland with a few quid in my pocket. I had some nice clothes that I got in Holland. You know, I was fairly well dressed, good shoes, you know, stuff like that. And I met this girl in the pub one night. And she was with a first cousin of mine. And I was out with a guy as well who was a cousin of mine. Now, that's what happens in localities here in Ireland. We're fucking nearly all related, you know. But, I had no memory of the night. I had no memory of meeting or anything. But I remember that it was the cousin that I was with, because he had a car. I didn't have a car at this stage. I remember so I thought, well, when I meet him, I'll beat around the bush. And you know, you can find out what happened without actually asking directly. You know, you get good at doing that, because I didn't want him to know I'd forgotten. But he remembered anyway. He told me that we had an arrangement to meet them again the following night, you know. So we met them again the following night, and I was on a bit better. I behaved a bit better the next night, and I got to know this girl and went out with her. And we went to a dance a few nights after that. And dances in Ireland then, they didn't have a bar, but they usually had a mineral bar, you know. And this particular dance hall had a mineral bar. It was upstairs, and myself and Mary were standing at the bottom of the stairs, and a fella came crashing down the stairs and whacked into Mary's head and knocked her out. So I, like a gentleman, took off my jacket and put her head on it and revived her, and we're together since. Like that's how that went, you know. And I remember I got sober on the last Wednesday in July in 1980. That was my timeline. It's easy for me to remember. It's a round figure. And our first child was born in May in 1981. And we got married in November. You know, that's the way here too. You need to get married if you're going to have a baby. You know, it makes things easier. It makes things run a lot smoother. We'd have done it anyway, I think. You know, we would have, by the looks of it. But yeah, our first kid was born in 81. Donna, she's doing well. She's sober 7. She celebrated 7 years sober there last month. You know, so that's a bit of good fortune. But we had four children altogether. Donna, Grace followed 2 years later in 83. And then in 87, we had David, boy. And then I think 6 years after that, we had Emma. Emma is the one that says we kept having children until we got one that we liked, you know. And it's true that we do like her, but we like the others as well. And she's the one that has the dog, you know. And she's the one with the fucking sense of entitlement as well, I have to say, you know. But she's the fourth child, and I'm the fourth child in of my family as well. So we talk about that sort of thing, you know. And the fourth child has had to listen to the parents dealing with all the shit the first three get into as they're coming along. You know, the last child is in line for a lot of that if it happens, you know. And in my family, yeah, I had an older brother that got himself into all sorts of trouble, and he caused an awful lot of worry and an awful lot of shame and all the shit in the family. And I had all that going on when I was drinking, but I never related to it really being the cause of me drinking, you know. I know some people would call it underlying problems, and possibly the drinking must to get out of that, but I still don't think that was really it. I think if that never had happened, I'd still have drank and I'd still have become an alcoholic, you know. I think. If I hadn't found drink, and if I'd met people at some place other than in pubs, and I hadn't drank, then I may not have become alcoholic. But I think that you know, the fact that the only place I could meet people and socialize was in pubs, And that involved quite a bit of drinking that I it became a thing. You know, I wanted to be a good drinker as well. I wanted to be like a respected drinker and that sort of thing, as a lot of the older people were. And that had kind of attracted me, you know, to a degree. But it was really what was in the bottle was attracting me, you know. It made me feel better, I guess. And but I didn't find it that hard to get off it. I did at first. Having to stop going in pubs, of course, was very difficult. I been hated that. I thought, you know, that seemed an awful threat, because a pub was everything to me. You know, it was like I've heard people say it was me estate agent and me employment agency. It was everything to me over the years, and stopping going in pubs was going to be very difficult. But it turned out that it wasn't really. It wasn't that hard in a way. I guess I gave in, you know. I gave in that it was true that if I went to pubs, I'd drink again. It was simple as that, you know. And I stopped going to them unless I had good reason to. And my wife, she takes a drink. She's fine. She never has more than three, you know. And she doesn't even like having the third one. She usually leaves half the third drink behind. If she, you know, if it happens that somebody gets her a drink, she hasn't looked for. But yeah, I can go out with her, but not all the time. If there's entertainment or something like that, I go out with her. But usually she goes down the pub with one of her friends on a Sunday night, and they play cards and they have, you know, to do what pubs are there for, to socialize, you know. And I usually go to a meeting on Sunday night. But I seen on the introduction there to the meeting, I just looked at it, that do you do literature at this meeting, or you talk about what you read or something like that, Mark?
If you have something you want to read and discuss, we can.
Not really. It's just I was just thinking. I had no idea that you'd done that until I just looked when I was coming on the meeting, you know, when I was pressing the button and he's got literature written on it. But I was just thinking that, you know, reading and that literature and that. For years I didn't really read anything very much, apart from Playboy magazines maybe and stuff like that, here and there, you know, which were necessary. But and reading the paper, of course, that was a regular thing. I was more of a radio person. I went to sleep by the radio, like for good 10 years of my life, like from all the time I was drinking, because I'd come home kind of half-pissed, and I'd put on the radio, and it was an absolute fucking disaster if the radio ran out of batteries. You know, it was only a battery radio. I remember the radio ran out of batteries. I didn't know what I'd do. You know, it was that important. And the first night that I really got so much identification with a fellow was a fellow shared that he knew he was in trouble when he found himself listening to the shipping forecast, you know. And the shipping forecast is on the radio quite late at night, you see. And if you're still listening to the radio that night, you're fucking lonely. You're either a fisherman or you're lonely. Like, that's one or the other, you know. But you can now buy a shipping forecast as a sleep app, believe it or not, you know. But I'm not going to get it. So reading didn't come into my life really, or the joy of reading didn't come into my life really until the children. And I was kind of lucky that I have an older sister that had reared her family ahead of ours. You know, she has four children as well, actually, in around London. And she was very good to us. She sent us on all her the books that she had got for her kids growing up. And there was a series of books out that time called Storyteller. And Storyteller, I don't know if any of you have ever seen them. They're quite big because they're all really well illustrated. And they're like about maybe 16 inches high by a foot wide. You know, that they were like that. They were really big. And we had the whole series of them that I read for my children as they grew up. And I'm really thankful for that, because, you know, no matter what bad times that I've had with the children, and when everything's gone to shit, you know, and we've had rows over things and all that, they still love me because I read those stories for them when they were kids growing up, you know. And it was a lovely experience to do it, you know. And I learned a good bit from it too. I mean, I'm fucking Pinocchio right to the you know, to the soles of my shoes, you know. It was Pleasure Island for me, like, and I could see myself in these stories, and they're all real parables. And I never had them as a kid myself. And nobody read, you know, there weren't books in our house really, and that was me. Kind of first time. I did read stories from each sister's children a bit, but not very much. But we got all these storytellers, and then we got the Dr. Seuss, the Cat in the Hat, and all that, and we'd be great fun with them. And the memories I have of like Donna and Grace, the older two, because there was only 2 years between them, so it wasn't very long until I was reading for both of them. And they were getting bigger, and they still wanted me down. And sometimes I might want to watch something on the TV, and I didn't want to go down. And they weren't le were learning to read themselves, so I'd start to read the fucking story all wrong, you know, if I was, and they'd get mad with me, and they'd say, "Dad, no, it's not that, and that's not what happened," and all this, you know. And eventually, they had to learn to read themselves much quicker than they normally would have, I think, to prove me wrong. But that was one saga. But the next saga was when David and Emma were growing up. See, there was nearly 6 years between them, and I was wondering how they overlapped. But Emma came on very quick as a child, and I was reading stories to David, and she was in the other bedroom close by, where she could just about hear us. But as soon as my time was up with David, even if I hadn't finished the chapter, she wouldn't let me finish the chapter. She would bawl and like fucking leave him and go into her. You know, you can imagine that. And we still remember that as a kind of a. They still, you know, they fucking still hate each other because of that, the competition between them. They don't hate each other now, they get on fine, but that's still a bone of contention with them, you know, that like Emma kind of took me away from David. And so that, like the value that those books gave us is unquantifiable, really, you know. And I was busy at work. I was a self-employed plumber for most of my life, which was a very busy life. I was always fucking up to my eyes doing something, or thinking about doing something, or planning doing stuff. So reading went out again for a long time, until I got unwell. I got sick. It's 17 years ago now. I know that because it's the same. My grandchild was born around the same time, and I had a stressful life, I think, maybe brought on by stress. My colon was giving me an awful lot of trouble, and I ended up with a stricture, and I had to go into hospital, and they had to remove most of it. And that was a bit of a life-changing operation, you know, but I still got back into good health after it, although I have a colostomy. But they tried to reverse that colostomy a year later, and that all went wrong, and I nearly died. And I was quite a while convalescing. But on my way home from the hospital, I called by my oldest daughter, Donna. And she had a boyfriend, a fella. He was from some from he was an English lad anyway, a lovely lad. And they had the God Delusion sitting on the shelf. So I borrowed it anyway and brought it home with me. And that was the first book I read for some years, I suppose, apart from all the AA stuff, you know. And I read The God Delusion, and like her boyfriend, Rob said, he said, if you're kind of leaning towards agnosticism or something like that, and you read The God Delusion, by the time you've finished it, you're going to be an atheist. And that's exactly what happened with for me, I think, you know, reading that book. Just it just proved a lot of the things I thought anyway, you know. But it just so since from that point on, my relationship with the AA and with the writings and the teachings and all that kind of changed a good bit. And luckily, then I had a brother in England that wasn't well, and I went over to visit him a few times, and I went to the meetings around Brixton and Clapham and all that. And I was looking in the Where to Find book, and every time I looked, I saw this meeting for atheists and agnostics in Islington, you know, and behind the screen on the green in Islington. And I wondered where it was, and would I, you know, to go to that meeting, I figured I'd have to leave Brixton at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the evening to go and make sure I find it and everything. It's at 7 o'clock, and it was a lot of bother. And I didn't go for a few fucking weeks. I didn't do it. But eventually I decided I would go, and I went to it, you know. And kind of the rest is history. I've had a connection with secular AA ever since, and it gave me a new lease of life completely in finding sobriety, you know, finding more contentment, you know, and different life altogether, really. Different. That part of my life is different, you know. An awful lot of the other parts of my life are much the same. They were good anyway, but But this part is so much more interesting and fulfilling and satisfying ever since that happened, you know. I've tried to try and trim that down as concise as I could, and I'm going to stop there. Thanks, never lovely to meet you all.